Hey yo, and here we go. It is Keith sitting in for all of the rest of the cast of We Talk Comics. To start off this episode, I just got back from Wizard World Chicago Comic Con, where I had a fantastic time with my guest for the news tonight, Matt Centauri Griffin.
Hey yo.
Matt, what did you think of Wizard World Chicago Comic Con? Yeah, you used to go to this show. You live in Chicago, yep. And you have not attended in several years.
That is true. I, ever since I was a little kid, maybe probably about 10, my dad would drop me off at Chicago's Comic Con, or maybe go with me, depending on how old I was. And I would go every year. It was like clockwork. And about 5 years ago, I stopped going. It was the year before C2E2 was announced. Wizard World has always had a difficult time because it's in August, which is after San Diego Comic-Con. As we know, San Diego Comic-Con used to be the place where lots of big news was announced by the comic companies. Not as much anymore. But Wizard World really suffered. And at a certain point, the comic companies stopped going. So flash forward 5 years later, and I was hesitant, I'd say, to go. But two things got me to want to go this year. One, of course, was Keith coming all the way to Chicago to attend the con. And, of course, we had an absolute blast. I can assure all listeners who may not even have the benefit of what I have had in seeing Keith from the nipples up on screen, that he does not have cloven hooves. He is actually of average height and a totally normal person. So I will, once I sign off, then Keith can talk about me. But the other thing that made me really want to go this year was that Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo were featured guests. And it is a very rare opportunity to get in front of those two guys, which Keith and I took full advantage of. And they were absolutely, positively the most gracious, kind, energetic, awesome people that we could have possibly talked to. I'll say that, Keith, chime in. I thought the show was really fantastic. I know Wizard's under new management or new ownership or something of the sort. So maybe that has some effect, but I thought that the scale of it was really awesome. They had amazing vendors, as both of our bruised shoulders will attest, and they really did bring out a lot of really good talent, which was pretty awesome.
I think Artist Alley was really great. Wizard World has a reputation for being celebrity focused. I would say that their advance promo was certainly celebrity focused. But that's neither here nor there for the actual experience once you're there. I mean, Artist Alley was a quarter of the square footage of the building, just about. And, there was tons and tons of creators there. No company presence aside from, Avatar. But we had Scott Snyder, we had Greg Capullo, Kyle Higgins. We had a lot of Image creators. The whole team of Revival was there. I will be talking to Tim Seeley later in this episode, writer of Revival. The Hoax Hunters guys are there. They'll be on the show here in a few weeks. Who else do we have? Stephen Grant. Art and Franco, of course, local boys.
Yep.
And I think if you wanted to get your comics autographed at Chicago Comic Con, there was probably 12 people there that worked on one of the issues or the first several issues of that book.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they really recruited a ton of awesome talent, and they were all or most in attendance. Ethan Van Sciver was there as well. Chris Claremont was there. I believe Alan Davis, although I don't know that I ever
saw Alan Davis. Claremont had the second longest line of the of the Artist Alley after Snyder and Capullo was a crazy line to try to get through.
It was actually easier for us to arrange an interview with the two of them than it was to get their autographs, which we managed to do the very last day. We got in line early on. So, and actually, one of the coolest things about the show was as we were in line for Snyder and Capullo, we started chatting with this woman who was standing right in front of us. And she was a brand new comic reader, had only been reading, I think, a year and a half,
she had said, yeah.
Okay. And this was her very first show, her very first day at her very first show, and she was standing in line to get Snyder and Capullo's signature on her Batman comics. And she was totally excited. I believe she had driven from Ohio to come, which is pretty, pretty dedicated, as far as I'm concerned.
She was having such an awesome time. It was great chatting with her. Name was Sarah. And it was terrific talking to her in line because, you know, Matt and I spend a lot of time inside the Twitter bubble, and there are good days and bad days being a comic fan on Twitter. And to talk to this young lady who is so excited about the comics she's reading, she's in love with every issue of Batman. Matt and I both gave each other a look when she said, "You know, it's a great hobby. It's really not that expensive."
Just wow, that's lovely to hear. It was just really refreshing, and you know, it's hard to remember how much people sometimes love comics until you go to a convention. And I know C2E2 is like this. I imagine Calgary Expo is like this. I certainly know from what the stories I've been told that San Diego Comic-Con is like this, is that people don't go there to bitch at creators. They don't go there to complain. They don't go there to go on and on and on about, you know, why everything is wrong. They go because they love it. And you don't stand in line for an hour to, and that's pretty conservative, an hour to get to meet Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo because you want to tell them what's wrong with what they're doing. I mean, you go because you love it. And it's a great environment. It's very, it's a very nice change, and it's very energizing.
I'll put solid money that in 3 days of signing autographs, no one walked up to Scott and Greg and said, "I don't know, 11 issues. Do you really?" sure it's amazing. Sure, it's going to be one of the best Batman stories ever. But 11.
Seriously. Well, and you know, not to change subjects, but it's curious. I just realized, having talked to the guys, that that 11 issues is actually broken into three segments. So it's not really 11 issues. It's 3 4-part stories or whatever. So I think we can all agree that there's nothing to complain about there.
Well, we'll get back to stories about Scott and Greg. What autographs did you get? You know, we are comic journalists. We're very hard nosed. We've got fedoras with a press tag sticking out the side.
Right.
But we're also fans.
Yeah.
So who are you most excited, outside of Scott and Greg, of course, who are you most excited to talk to? What kind of stuff did you grab at the show?
Let's see, who did we get autographs from? Let's start there, and then I can tease a little bit of some interviews that we have coming up. Autographs, I got Art and Franco, of course, and I got a really awesome Catman sketch from Art, Balthazar, and it is probably the start of my new sickness, which will be my Catman sketch collection, of which I already have a very exquisite Brett Booth full-page sketch of Catman. But now I have several to add to that. But Art put little scratches and bloody scratches on him, and he's still adorable, and that was awesome. Got Ethan Van Sciver to sign my three pivotal Green Lantern moments that he drew for Rebirth and Sinestro Corps War and the last annual that led to the end of the series. We met Gene Ha, got his autograph. I have my little stack here. Who else? Oh, other people.
There was a young artist, and I don't have his name handy, that was doing $1 sketches. I got a Booster Gold. You got a Catman.
His name was Kurt Wood.
Kurt Wood, thank you. And those were great. Those are cute little sketches he did in about 10 minutes.
Absolutely adorable. And I also bought a nice print of the Minions from I'm totally blanking. The movie. What is it? You're gonna have to edit this. of the Minions dressed as Batman and Robin for my niece, and because she loves both those things. But and the My Catman sketch for that is just adorable. We got to talk to Chris Burnham a little bit and get his autograph. That was super cool.
And you got to find out just how out of your price range page of Chris Burnham art is.
Yes. I was sort of googly-eyed looking at the page that reveals the return of Kathy Kane, and then discovered it was way out of my price range. But that's okay, because it was really pretty and it was nice to see. Speaking of out of my price range, also got an autograph for my husband from Neil Adams on a $20 print, because I could not afford the $3,000 original art. That was at the low end of what he was selling. But Neil Adams is a legend, and he was a perfectly nice guy. Of course, he caught me at a moment where he was showing off the end of Batman Odyssey to someone, and he made me watch the guy's face to see his reaction, which was always, which was pretty amusing. Really, words don't share how uncomfortable that moment was. it was really cool. We got to talk to a lot of people, and the Hoax Hunters guys were awesome. Just meeting them, and I know Michael Morici lives in Chicago, so not very far from me, in fact. So probably hang out with him sometime, hopefully. Got to talk a little with Jenny Frizon, who does covers for a number of books, including this week, today's Red Sonja, number 2. She was on a panel about essentially about women in comics, which was a little weird, but she was absolutely incredible and really pleasant and interesting. We did sit through a bunch of panels. You know, Wizard World's panel offerings aren't, you know, super fascinating. They're neither incredibly academic, nor are they, do they have any company presence. So you're not going to get announcements or anything from DC or Marvel or anything like that. But the real stars, of course, were Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo. Scott was on 4 different panels throughout the weekend, and I can say that Keith and I were practically front row for all 4. In fact, we were even asked to move out of the front row for one, and we refused.
We absolutely refused, because they didn't actually ask us. They just said, you might not want to sit there. I mean, that's passive aggressively asking.
I mean, it made it sound like we were going to be like hit with a split watermelon or something. It wasn't like we might want some people in cosplay to sit up here. Then I might not have moved, but I might have been a little less curious about it. They can sit on the floor. It's not. I'm old.
Just,
I don't need to.
They're just cosplayers.
Yeah, not I mean. Really. Well, they're real people.
Of course,
real people in there somewhere. But they're young.
But they're young and we are crazy. We are crazy old.
Yeah, right?
I've got to stand in the. I got to be in the front row because I can't even make it between those aisles. The bursitis and the consumption.
Yeah.
I got a good stack of autograph stuff as well. I got the latest issue of Batman, which has a cool cover signed by the guys. I got Project Superman signed by Gene Ha and Scott Snyder, which is kind of neat. A couple of things by Chris Burnham. I was able to get the Hoax Hunters convention exclusive cover, which is a parody of the old Friday the 13th Nintendo game, which was why I'd say it was 20% because it was Hoax Hunters and 80% because it was a parody of the old Friday the 13th game. And I also grabbed the Thanos Rising Scotty Young variant. And got Scotty. Scotty Young was there. Hey,
that's
Scotty
right,
Young.
Scotty.
And Matt had also given me one of a print of the Uncanny Avengers variant cover. So I got the two of those signed. That Thanos is just adorable. And little Thanos, too awesome.
Yeah. Scott. Yes, I totally forgot Scotty Young, but he's a big name. He lives in Chicago. And actually, if listeners want to see the full glory of some Scotty Young variants, they should head on over to Comicosity and check out one of our latest Comic Love columns, which is all about Scotty Young variants.
Absolutely. You got 30, 35, I think, are up there. I had no idea there were that many. And it is up to date with this week's Scotty Young variant, which was on the Infinity.
Mm-hmm.
The variant this week, so it is up to date, and oh, they're so cute.
Yeah,
they're adorable.
One of the awesome things that I got at the show too was Greg Capullo was selling a print of the cover of, I guess it would be Batman 18, which was the reaction to the death of Damian issue. And it was the cover with Damian's boots that have the Robin just sitting on the boots. And what I did not realize until I started chatting with Greg was that cover was inspired by photographs taken during the Holocaust of children's shoes that had been stacked up, you know, as children were led into the furnaces. They were, of course, asked to leave behind their shoes, and there are these really evocative, heart-wrenching photos of their shoes left behind, and that's what inspired him with this cover. So, of course, I immediately bought the print and had him and Scott sign it. It will be framed for my wall, but not that it wasn't exceptionally beautiful before, but, you know, especially living in a Jewish home, I just feel so touched by the cover image now for more than one reason, not just my love of Damien, which has never gone away.
That's right. I read my little Gotham faithfully every 2 weeks because Damien lives.
And he's also in Injustice.
He is also in Injustice. As if Injustice had to be any better.
Right.
Still, Damien's just a touch older than Injustice.
Yes. Yeah, he's like a teenager.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, it's one of.
Well, Injustice is set in the future.
Yeah, one of the two future Damien books that we'll have. We have this Damien Son of Batman story coming up.
Correct. Yeah, the Adam Kubert book.
Yeah, that comes up, starts in October, I believe.
Andy Kubert.
Andy. Adam Kubert.
Andy, thank you.
Yeah, and Matt and I each walked away with a giant stack of trade paperbacks, I think, and hardcovers. Isaac,
yeah, your stack was massive. I don't know how you got that home.
I guessed I packed my suitcase. Matt thought the suitcase seemed heavy. It came out to 52 pounds of my 50-pound limit. So I pulled four trades, and that was perfect. It actually measured at 50.0 when I pulled out four trade paperbacks. So
nice.
And I did also have some in my carry-on already, but I just threw a few extras.
You really only had to carry 30 books in your carry-on.
Something like that. I read a couple on the flight back.
Sure.
I got a couple of the Before Watchmen hardcovers, and I read Ozymandias on the flight, and that book read so well as one big sit, actually.
Oh, really? Yeah, I'll have to try that. Because I did review two of the collections, and I thought, actually, for the most part, most of them read better as a full collection. It was real, especially Night Owl. I was not a fan of Night Owl as it was coming out, but the story, as I read it now, really, really good.
Oh, good. I do intend to get the others. I got the one that has Ozymandias, and I got the one that has the Silk Spectre.
Sure. That one I've not reread, but I loved both of those stories intensely when they first came out as well. So
yeah, the dollar bill issue is in the Ozymandias one as well. It's Crimson Corsair dollar bill, and then the six issues of the other one. So, but beautiful looking books. Well, we'll come back to some more convention stories. Let's do a little news. As always, the news is sponsored by Comicosity, the greatest site on the web for news, reviews, previews. And, how percentage wise, Matt, what percentage of the website is dedicated to, TV and film news about comics?
That would be a big old zero.
0%. That's lower than most sites.
That I would say that's probably lower than most sites. Yes.
Okay. And all kinds of features will turn up, someone putting all of the Scotty Young variants in one spot.
Right.
Also some sales analysis, numbers game. Every once in a while, I come up with something that I write and throw in. Between the lines. Go ahead.
We also have weekly reviews. And it's funny because I was talking to a very cool gentleman on Twitter the other day, and we were talking about Vertigo Comics and creator-owned comics and indies and whatnot, and about the general lack of reviews for non-big two superhero, non-superhero books. And, I did a little number crunching, actually, and I looked at Comicosity, and I found that a full one-third of our reviews for the previous month were indie books, and I think that sets us apart in some ways from a lot of sites, because we really do love to bring comics that we love to everyone, and that's not just exclusive to Marvel and DC. Although, as everyone knows, I'm a very huge DC fan, and my partner Aaron Long is a very huge Marvel fan. So. But we both love great comics, no matter who's publishing them. So that's a commitment that we've put into the site as well.
All right, well let's do a little bit of news. It is still August, so news is light. But there was some breaking news. It's Wednesday. It's New Comic Day as we record this. There was some news today that Matt Fraction. Will be stepping away from Fantastic Four and FF. He's been writing both of those books since the relaunch. And he will be done at issue 11 of FF and 12 of Fantastic Four. Those books will be taken over by Carl Kiesel on Fantastic Four and Lee Allred on FF. That is the brother of Mike Allred, who presumably will be staying on the book. And what's your reaction? The story is that Fraction is swamped with Inhumanity and Inhuman, which is the ongoing relaunch of the Inhumans in Marvel now.
Sure. Yeah, it sounds just like he has a lot of projects going on. He's got a lot of balls in the air, and he's got to give something up. I will say Fantastic Four and FF have not been huge sellers for Marvel. They've actually, if FF is now below the point at which it was before the relaunch. And that's there's no disparagement there because I'm a huge FF fan. I love that book. I think it is exceptional. I think one of the most I don't know, the coolest thing about the book is when I realized, because somebody told me I wasn't that smart myself, that FF did not actually stand for Fantastic Four Future Foundation. It in fact stands for Found Family. And that book I just think is so unique on the shelf, and hopefully it will continue to be as unique with the new writer and with the existing artist, who I also adore. I'm not reading Fantastic Four, so I can't really comment too much about that, but I can see why Marvel would probably want someone like Matt Fraction to move on to a project they think will sell probably a little bit better, or at least give it a shot.
I was quite taken with FF. I did get turned off on it a few issues in, so I will eventually try it again. I'm pretty much on record as not being a huge Fraction fan. I absolutely despise the first issue of Fantastic Four. So I actually, because I've never come across any Fraction work I liked aside from FF, I put a lot of weight on the quality of that book on Mike Allred to start. I think that his, I think that was a real partnership in writing as opposed to him writing from a script. So I think that I think we may be pleasantly surprised by the change in this book, that we may see very little change in the tone and et cetera.
Yeah, I'm not worried at all about that. Shouldn't and Carl Kiesel as well is a very known quantity, very solid writer. If anything, I think the book will maybe improve for people or give people a shot if they weren't didn't want to follow it before. I have to say I'm actually also a big, and I know you aren't, Keith, but I'm a big fan of Fraction's Hawkeye, as is most of the known world.
I'm not a fan. I will say that. It hasn't grabbed me the way that it has others, but it certainly is not one that I have anything that I have a grudge against or anything.
It is another artist book, though, definitely. And there are very few artist book on the market if you really think about it these days. Really, we're in a period of time where writers are really the big superstars, unless you have like an exceptional collaboration, like Snyder and Capullo. The writers usually get most of the attention, but in this case, I think Hawkeye and FF, I think that's not really the case.
Let's see what else we got going on. We have seen sales numbers for July. We'll be covering this in much more detail on Comicsology in the numbers games columns that come up. But you've seen what it looks like, and what was the number again? 22 out of 20 out of the top 25 are ongoing books.
Yes, that was something that you felt really, really, I don't know if proud of, but you were impressed by.
I was in a time when the event books are so dominant, and we are expecting that the August numbers will likely have Infinity number one as the top book. I don't know what is going to have competition with Infinity. I mean, there's rumors Infinity may be as high as a 250,000 copies. So we'll see in a few weeks' time exactly where that ends up. But I like, aside from the Batman Annual, we've got 9 out of 10 that are not only. Let me try that again. 8 out of 10 are ongoing books that are not number one. So there's some real strength. We've got 5 books over 100,000 copies. As usual, we get our numbers from Comics Chronicles and Superman Unchained number 2, top book, Batman, Guardians of the Galaxy. Guardians of the Galaxy is staying really strong.
Well, Guardians of the Galaxy got about a $30,000 or $30,000 30,000 copy push because of Neil Gaiman's name on the cover, because the previous issue was in the 80s.
And of course
Still very solid,
and of
mind
course
you.
the groundswell of support for Angela.
Yes. Because everyone's been waiting for Angela.
Right. This was a running joke between Matt and I the entire weekend. We spent the weekend hunting for the elusive Angela fans who were desperate for the return of Angela. We were not successful. We saw discounted Angela action figures. We saw half price Angela trade paperbacks. But we did not find an actual Angela fan in the wild.
No. That was we couldn't spend the whole weekend just being optimistic and positive. It, you know, put Cub Recorder K and Photo Cup together in a room and you've got to have a little bit of release valve. Otherwise it might just be, I mean, flowers might start coming out of our mouths and rainbows just spontaneously appearing.
We decided that Angela was going to be the target of our snark for the weekend.
Yes. Yes. Fair target. One interesting thing about the sales chart, Batman Annual number 2 hitting number 5 on the chart. That is written, in fact, by a female writer, which is a very rare occurrence to have a female writer in the top 10. Marguerite Bennett, who is brand new, if you can believe it, brand new to writing comics. And her first out of the gate is number 5 on the charts. It was co-plotted with Scott Snyder, but she did the bulk of the work, and it's an exceptional issue if you haven't checked it out. I did an interview with her, and she is definitely a talent to watch out for. She's going to be doing the upcoming Lobo Villains Month special as well.
Well, Villains Month, let's talk about that for a minute. So we've heard that Villains Month, the 3D covers, the super duper, super awesome. They're losing money on them. They had to order them months in advance. These covers will be allocated to retailers. They've been vague on what the math is involved. It has something to do with your previous orders, as opposed to just everyone's getting 90% of your order.
Right.
So we're seeing a lot of chit chat on Twitter. And some conflicting viewpoints on this. What's your reaction to this announcement that DC will be allocating?
Well, you know, it's always disappointing when a comic company can't provide enough for everybody to get what they want. I will say that DC has an exceptional record, as does Marvel, for overprinting as well as rushing to second printing on things that people really want. When the New 52 launched, they went out and they got more issues in the stores. They really supported the stores. So I feel like this is really a situation where they wanted to do something super cool. They didn't know that it would be as popular as it would be, based on maybe some store, you know, it's not negativity, but maybe a little lighter orders the last few months to year. They thought they were covering themselves. And to part of this too, is that they are working with a material that is not, as readily available. It's, coming from overseas. And being in publishing myself, I've dealt with a little bit of overseas ordering of products, and it is an enormous pain to get stuff from Japan or China. Basically they're just coming up short. So their solution, which oddly enough is making many, many people happy, is to also print 2D covers, so normal covers, just whatever, at the original price of $2.99, that people can have the choice to buy. So you can get your 3D cover for the $3.99, you can get your 2D cover for the $2.99, and as a result of this, which I know makes Keith very happy, and me to a degree as well, the digital edition of each of these books will now be $2.99, as opposed to, I think probably the original plan was to match the store price. So this is a great thing. I've seen a lot of people who buy primarily digital who are now willing to try a lot more of these books because they feel like they're not getting ripped off. You know, it gives people who are in the stores who maybe don't care about the gimmick. I mean, it's a gimmick. It may be a very cool one, but who can, you know, budget a little bit better. And then you have the hardcore people who really want those covers, and they're going to either get them at their store, or if the stores come up short, they're gonna have to look at for them as collector's items. It doesn't really do DC any good that they can't allocate these, or they can't give 100% of their stock. Obviously, like the more they sell to a store, the more money they make. So there's no shenanigans, you know, backroom shenanigans going on. That there's no advantage for them to be limiting their orders. It's just the thing they have to do. The one advantage that stores may have down the road is if they are able to get their hands on some of these things, either after the first month or through resale, they'll probably be able to mark those things up for resale pretty high. So they could end up being quite the collector's item, which, you know, doesn't really affect me one way or the other, but so yeah, that's the long and the short of it.
I can wait 3 or 4 years and get those for cover price again, if I want one for my wall or something. Sure. The Two-Face cover was kind of neat, but I think until we actually can eyeball these things, and the thing that kind of bugs, I'm seeing two things that one of them has to be untrue. One of them is that I'm seeing retailers who are complaining that the $2.99 regular covers and the $2.99 digital is undercutting them on the $3.99 book, and they're afraid of getting stuck with them. So I've seen a few retailers say that. There's some retailers that are just upset that they're getting allocated. And then I'm seeing buyers who are upset that they're now scared they're not going to be able to find the $3.99s.
Sure. Sure.
Now, I think there's some risk in the I can't find them. But the reality is that the early orders were high, DC printed high, the final orders were just even higher than that. I don't really have any fear that these are going to be hard to find.
Yeah, I'm not super worried about it, and I'll tell you why. Although there are some instances that we've heard of anecdotally that there's not enough being allocated to cover subscriber lists, I feel fairly certain that most stores were ordering based on their subscribers plus a significant amount over. So if you are a subscriber to a store, as I would recommend to anyone who collects comics on a regular basis, and you pre-ordered those books, as I did at my store, you're pretty much guaranteed you'll be getting them. I have already talked to my store manager, and she told me not to worry. But the other thing is the first part of that really can't be true. The store owners can't have it both ways. They can't be both upset that they're not getting their full order and then also feel like they're going to get undercut and not sell out of what they ordered by the lower price. You can't have it both ways. You're either not getting enough or you're going to be left with too many. So I would say pick a story as an industry and go with it. I suspect that what will happen is that maybe they'll come up short a little bit. I'm sure there'll be some title they'll end up having more than they need on. But, you know, DC's not sending anyone more than somebody ordered in the first place. So that's there. They should be pretty safe there. I doubt these are going to be sitting on the shelf very long. From what I hear, they're pretty pretty cool. And $4, although it is more than the usual DC books, it's not more than the usual Marvel book. And so it's not out of range for what a buyer would pick up on a whim.
And I am curious to see the covers. I mean, I'm sure that the coolest. I'm sure the Joker one will be hard to find, and some of the characters that are that just visually are going to be a cooler thing. Because, I mean, certainly my only thought of getting one of these books or a couple of these books is if the gimmick cover is just real neat enough to put up on the wall or something.
Sure.
Same as any other gimmick cover. I don't know how many back in the day there were a lot of gimmick covers that were removed from the rest of the book and framed, etc. The whole collection of black and white or of glow in the dark covers, but no books attached to them at one point. I think the cover's more interesting than the rest. So November in DC, we have three events going on at the same time. DC does have about half the line. It's not as many as some thought it was. When you actually go through the solicits, it's give or take about half the line is involved in one of the three events. We've got Forever Evil. We've got New Krypton. Or not New Krypton, sorry, Return to Krypton.
Sure.
And then we have Zero Year. What's the effect of one of these crossover events on a book? Is it still a sampling opportunity, or does it just give a one issue bump these days?
My analysis has been that it's more or less a one, maybe two issue bump. But from what we've seen after the Joker storyline, after the Night of the Owls, the books tend to go back to their existing levels. There's not a whole lot of long-term bump associated with these things. Certainly those issues go up, and that does help the bottom line. But, DC in particular, since we're talking about DC, they really value, from what I can tell on their charts, they really value stability. So it's not... of course, they do things that they want to bump up, but they're not going they don't seem to be wanting to force creators into these kind of storylines. So, for instance, Wonder Woman has not taken part in any of these storylines, nor has Batwoman. And, of course, out of all of the books, Batwoman is the one exception. After now going on three Batman one-month crossovers, Batwoman has yet to participate in any of them. And Batwoman would be one of DC's most solidly creative, well thought of books in their line. Mm-hmm. So I gotta believe that if they have an exception, every book has an exception. And every creator I've talked to has taken it as an opportunity. They've not spoken to me either on or off the record about it being something that was forced upon them. So it's interesting, and I think particularly with Zero Year coming up in November, where you see books like The Flash and Green Lantern Corps, books you would never associate with the Batman line taking part, that's got to be something that was opened up and offered as opposed to demanded. It wouldn't make sense otherwise. But as far as long-term effects, yeah, I don't see it.
Green Lantern Corps is an interesting one to put in because there was the never confirmed rumor they were going to kill Jon Stewart, and now we have a really high profile connection. We've also had the Green Lantern books doing their own thing, contained in those four books for 2 years now, and now they're starting to break off from being a unit of four books.
Sure, and, which I think is good. I think the more they can do that, the better, actually.
Yeah, I think it almost seemed like a party line kind of thing that you got like three of the four, or you got none. I've heard very few people say that they were getting. I mean, maybe Green Lantern, but I heard very few people saying I'm getting Red Lantern. That's not the only Lantern book I'm getting.
Yeah, I was only buying Green Lantern until the creative teams changed, and now I am buying Green Lantern and Red Lanterns. Oh, and Larfleeze, if you count that.
Larfleeze, oh, of course, Larfleeze is that. Yeah.
But But yeah, I am not. I did not out of the original four. No, I only bought the one, and I read it. I never bought any of the crossover issues, and I never had any problem. Always understood where the story was going. Always made sense to me. It would absolutely not required reading.
They were pretty well structured events. I mean, I was reading three of the four through the events.
Sure.
Core I kind of came on and off of, and Red Lanterns. I think I dropped it for a couple of months and then came back for one of the big events.
Okay.
All right, well, that's the news. Let's do a
Well,
couple more. Sorry, go ahead.
I did have one thing that was announced during Wizard World, not in association with, well, two things actually, not in association with Wizard World, but at the same time, Brett Booth is going to be the alternating story arc artist for Batman Superman. So as Jay Lee, as I'm sure we all could predict, I mean, Jay Lee is not a monthly artist. He's an exceptionally beautiful artist, but as he needs to take time between issues, Brett Booth will be doing the alternating arcs. That makes me very happy. I'm a big Brett Booth fan, and that will be starting with issue 5, I believe. And then the other big news is that the Crime Syndicate of America has finally been confirmed as the big bads behind Forever Evil. So you will be seeing the traditional five team of Ultraman, Superwoman, Owlman, Power Ring, and Johnny Quick, joined immediately by a Firestorm analog called Deathstorm, which should be familiar to long-term DC fans.
It's a
And
I
that's
know you were so excited about this. You had called this really early on, and you were pretty jazzed when the announcement happened that it was Brett.
I'm pretty jazzed. I'm a big fan of that group, and the fact that they're from Earth 3, it's just it's gonna be a wild ride. So I'm all in.
Forever Evil kicks off in September. Villains Month, as Trinity War ends up. I haven't read the latest issue of Trinity War. Can't wait to read this, read that before bed tonight. I hope it doesn't give me nightmares. It's an intense story that's going on. Part 4 of 6, and then, when part 6 comes out, we go right into Forever Evil, Villains Month, and, 7 months of, the first event in, the New 52. First
Yes.
proper event. We've got these little crossover tie-in things. They're wishy-washy events. This is an event.
Oh, one more thing. I see we could do this all night. Just announced today, rather informally in just some solicits, or maybe yesterday, Phil Jimenez is going to be drawing and writing an arc on Savage Wolverine.
Oh, I had
So
not
that
heard that.
Yes, so that will be the first time I will be buying Wolverine in print since Mark Miller did Old Man Logan, and before that it would have been Greg Rucka's run. So
Yeah,
you're getting me to buy Wolverine, Marvel.
I've never read Old Man Logan.
It's a very good story. It's very good. Very good.
I've heard it's actually the best-selling trade paperback of all
Oh, really? That's
time. I
interesting.
had heard that.
I truly, truly enjoyed it. And again, I am, an informal or infrequent Marvel fan, and I am not a huge Wolverine person. So that I think so highly of that book is and keep it in my collection is definitely a compliment to it.
All right, okay, so and that's the news. We'll do a little bit more here of convention stories. Coming up, we've got the creative change on Earth 2. You did an interview with Ethan Van Sciver, who's doing covers on Earth 2 starting in October. So October or
Yes.
November, he starts at covers.
I'm sorry, November.
November, that's right. And it was funny that I was and Matt and I were standing there chatting with him and just saying that we saw the cover art had come out for his first issue of the first issue of Earth 2 that he's doing cover art on. a great picture of the Earth 2, the new Earth 2 Batman. And so Matt was, you know, this was, it's such a cool image. It's so great. And Ethan just flips open the portfolio in front of him and goes, oh yeah, this is the picture. And he's got the original art for that cover just sitting there in front of us. Neither of us asked how much the price point was on that.
Oh no. Yeah, covers I know are way beyond me.
And a nice Batman only cover from a popular title.
Yeah. Nope. But I will give a little tease to something that Ethan shared in an interview with me, is that he was specifically asked to draw the Batman of Earth 2 as bulkier and more like the Batman from Dark Knight Returns. So I don't know whether that gives any hints or not to the identity of the Earth 2 Batman. However, Tom Taylor has said that we will find out very, very soon once he starts his run.
And Ethan told us that he knew, but he wouldn't tell us. And
yes,
he neither confirmed nor denied my theory that it's Thomas Wayne.
Correct.
He seemed to not so much confirm. He didn't. It wasn't like a, oh my God, you figured it out kind of look on his face. It was more of a, oh yeah, I see where you're going.
Yeah. No, it wasn't. It was not. Not definitive in any way, shape, or form.
We also, I went to 4 panels on the weekend. Coincidentally, Scott Snyder was at 4 panels on the weekend. So we did get, there was a few things that were in those panels that I had not heard before. And we have an upcoming, there'll be an upcoming interview with Scott and Greg that'll be on Comicosity soon, and it'll be on We Talk soon after. And Matt and I did that interview together. It was very, very cool to just sit. We basically sat knee to knee with the guys and talked for almost a half an hour. I think they only did two or three, like three or four interviews the entire weekend, and we were lucky enough to be one of those. Probably the most interesting panel for me was the collaboration panel, where it was Scott and Greg talking about their relationship and how they work together, how they create together, how they didn't get along when they first started working together, but have developed this incredibly close relationship both personally and creatively. And also taken by some of the things that we found out about how stories evolve over the time. And Matt, what did we find out about how Death of the Family might have gone?
Well, there was a lot of speculation that Death of the Family would end with Alfred's death. Well, that was never even considered. But what was considered was having the Joker cut off Alfred's left hand and mail it to Bruce. They felt like that would be a real shocker, that it would have a long-lasting effect. Ultimately, editorial was not very fond of the idea, apparently. But Scott also started, I guess, thinking about, 20 years from now and having Alfred with his little stump and just how sad that might make him. And so they decided not to go that route.
I love Scott's line when he said that he was sending these angry emails saying, I'm taking that hand. That's my hand. he was pretty set on it for a bit, but I respect that. It's something I've grumbled about from time to time, that sometimes you do a story and you're thinking of how it affects the story, which, in some ways you should be loyal to the story you're telling right now, but it's a shared universe. Everyone else is going to have to deal with a one-handed Alfred from then on. And is that really in service of the character? And ultimately you're serving the characters more than, and the property. You have to think outside of that one story.
Yeah. We also got a little bit of a tidbit from Scott in one of the panels about why One of the reasons that he was eager to do Zero Year, you know, a story that took him away from the rest of the Batman universe for 11 issues. You know, he's felt really strongly that in the wake of the death of Batman's son, that he just couldn't tell that story. Part of it was, of course, trusting Pete Tomasi to tell that story exceptionally well. And then one of the things I did like to hear was how much respect the two guys have for all the other people in the Bat offices. They feel really connected to all those writers, Gail and Kyle and Pete and all the others. But he said that he really couldn't tell that story. It was actually too scary for him, being the father of a son. You know, it just wasn't something that he was emotionally able to do. So he removed Batman from it, to tell this other story that he felt was equally or perhaps, you know, more important, which you'll hear a lot about in the interview that we conducted.
And we're about to finish the first arc of the big arc of Zero Year, and he did tell us at the panel what the name of the second arc is.
Go ahead.
It is Cold Cases.
Yeah, that's the name of the story arc that comes after the 11 issues of Zero Year. Yeah,
which is also a Riddler story.
No.
That panel?
Yeah. That is one thing that we actually had Scott confirm, is that Zero Year is his big Riddler story, but that the story coming after Zero Year in its entirety is called Cold Cases, and we do know that it involves some amount of detective work and that Harper Row will have a big role. We do not know who the villain is.
Okay. And we also heard, and so no, please hold the conspiracy theories on why they did this. There are text changes to the Death of the Family collection. Scott has said that he made dialogue tweaks.
Oh yeah, Scott said he wanted to make dialogue.
Yeah.
Tweaks.
So, but I mean, we've lived through a year and a half of why they made the change to the Red Hood and the Outlaws trade, and they made the change to the Teen Titans trade. Scott wanted to do it. Is why they did it.
This is more of a case of a writer who published a piece that they feel like maybe there's just one little last thing that they wanted to change, and maybe just can't leave it well enough alone. It's not for me to judge, but no, it was definitely an artistic decision made by the writer himself.
All right, Matt. Well, thanks again for letting me stay in your spare room, and thanks for going to the convention. And it was just a blast. I just had the time of my life. It was so fantastic.
We did too. I had an awesome, awesome time over the weekend. I know John loved the scotch tasting and all the other stuff. And truly, like, you are more than welcome anytime. Any place you want.
It was greatly appreciated. I had a laugh the first night when there was pizza, Chicago deep dish pizza waiting when we got there from the airport, and we're sitting, we're chatting, and John looks over at me and he says, "Listening to your talk, I keep waiting for Mo to start talking." It's just me when the solo act on the road is just
right.
Don't bring the whole touring gang.
All right, let's talk about Revival.
All right, shoot.
So, a rural noir. It's a bit of horror. It's a bit of noir. It's a bit of a mystery. Where are we at right now in the story?
Issue 13 comes out next week. So basically, we're sort of following up on the character M, who is one of the revivers, one of the people who's come back, had to save her sister's family, her son, by totally killing all these drug dealer guys who were actually like selling body parts to of revivers to other people. So yeah, it sounds really complex if you've never read it, but basically that's where we are. In the last issue, it was sort of them dealing with the fact that the kid saw the you know, these terrible things happen, and just how affected was he by what he saw.
So how much is the world changing in as people find out about the revivers and as this spreads out?
Like the thing that we've kind of established in the book is that you don't really know much about the rest of the world's reaction to it, because we really want it to feel very insular and really about the town. Their world is profoundly affected in that they can't leave. They're under quarantine until they figure out what's going on. We recently, you know, revealed that the water sources have been found to be radioactive. So they're really, you know, scrambling to figure it out. In the rest of the world, you don't really see it. And we want to do a storyline coming up where you finally see how the rest of the world reacted to it, and just how much, you know, something like this would just ripple across the entire planet and, you know, force people to rethink religion and force people to rethink a whole lot of things that we, you know, take for granted on a, you know, daily basis. So, but really we wanted to focus very much early on the characters and the city and how it affects them.
And it is completely localized to this one community then?
So far, yeah.
Well,
I mean, that's definitely part of the story, is that why is it this place? You know, why did this happen here? Is there a cause of it? Is it an act of God? Is it science? And we know, but we love to see people figure it out. That's kind of the best part about it, I think. So the interaction is...
So as the series has gone on, you've evolved the style a bit, because the tone of it. When it started, it very much felt like, is it a Walking Dead thing? Is it a horror thing? But it's become really character-focused.
Yeah, definitely.
So was that where you started from, or has it evolved kind of organically as you went?
I mean, we knew that we really wanted that to be sort of the point of it, that we knew it wanted to be about the people. But I think, you know, starting it out, we had to really... That first issue was completely sort of crafted to be like this, oh my God, what the hell was that? And then after that, we slowly sort of introduced all these people and their relationships. And then basically up through issue 11, you pretty much meet everybody that is going to follow through the rest. So I think for some people, it's like, why are there so many characters in this? Like, no, that's it. Then they're the people that you find out how they're all attached to each other. And their relationships kind of play out for the rest of the series. So, we actually kind of know what we're doing, which is frightening because I usually wing it. But with this one, we have so many things figured out that it's kind of scary to know that we have to get there to make this all, you know, totally work.
How big is the plan then? How scoping is this story?
It's like a 60 issue story, basically. You know, we've got room in there for play, so if we want to do something... We kind of thought of it as a five-season show, basically. So it's like, okay, the first season sort of sets up the character, the second season is about how they...
So 60 issues.
Yeah.
And what are the influences on this story? Because, I mean, there's the obvious horror stuff, Stephen King...
Which was not intentional, because I've actually never read a Stephen King novel.
Oh, really?
I haven't. I know we totally read like a Stephen King thing, but I've actually never read one. I feel bad about that, but I haven't. Do you want me to sign those?
Please, if you wouldn't mind.
Well,
no one can accuse you of cribbing if you've never read it.
Yeah, yeah. Which, I should be ashamed of that, because...
But George Harrison got in trouble for subliminal, what was it, subconscious stealing. So,
yeah. You know. Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest influence on it was just sort of when I grew up on zombie stuff. I loved the Romero stuff, all the films and old horror comics, and part of it was just sort of wanting to do a different take on it. And growing up in Wausau, I thought, you know, what if it was about the quarantine, about being stuck with these people? And that was sort of inspired by when you're a teenager living in a town like Wausau and it snows, you've got like cabin fever like crazy, you feel like it's the end of the world, there's nowhere else to go, that you're stuck here. And that was just sort of which I'm sure is the genesis for a lot of, you know, those sort of things like that Stephen King did and stuff. And then the other big influence was actually the Coen brothers, I think Fargo is obviously a big yeah. influence on it. And then just sort of the pacing of like Swamp Thing or the Alan Moore Swamp Thing comics was a big influence on like how we paced it out, you know.
So there's a lot more sweaters than spandex in this thing.
Yes, yeah, it's definitely not a superhero book. But, yeah, that aspect of the way the Alan Moore stuff was set up, where it's like that first issue sort of sets the world for you instantly, and then you sort of build characters over time and they all come together, that was sort of an idea.
So where do we go from here? You've got your cast, you've got your... You've got the drama.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Yeah. Now it has to be about, you know, the little interactions and the sort of building of tension, because I think it's about, as time goes on, these people are forced to deal with more stuff, and they're learning more about, you know, what was originally just this bizarre mystery. They're going to start finding out what is going on and how they'll be affected by that. So I'm actually, like, the issues... 13 to 14, I think we really figured out some cool stuff that I'm actually really happy with.
Inside or outside?
Outside being fine.
Okay.
But yeah, like my personal interest in is more of the sort of crime stuff and like the people, how do people react in the situation? Thanks, man.
Appreciate it.
Okay, cool, man. You just signed up?
Thank you.
And I think, you know, the horror stuff for me is a way to make you feel for those characters, I think. For Mike, I think he likes the more the horror aspect, but I think it works out nice.
Well, it's an interesting approach to have the zombies actually have an experience in the story.
Yeah.
That it's zombies you can negotiate with.
Yeah. Well, and part of the problem, one of the things that we, I mean, I love zombie stuff, but they're all sort of about the same thing, which in the end is a survivalist story, and then it's sort of In the situation, can you pop one in the head of Grandma, but she's mindless and it's not really her anyway? And we're like, well, what if it really was her? I mean, you're not sure. She's pretty much the same. But there's something weird about it, right? So it changes. I think it's not a survivalist story anymore. It's sort of a, it's more, you know, more of a human story about, you know, how do people deal with that situation? And, you know, there's always opportunists to take advantage of things. And it's, you know, sort of about, like, how people use religion to... or any situation to further their cause. So in this case, it's like, well, this proves God exists, and other people are like, no, this proves God doesn't exist. And, you know, I mean, it's sort of more about those sort of things, too. Opportunists.
Now, where are we at with Hack Slash?
We wrapped the series at 25, and then we're doing the Hack Slash versus Army of Darkness crossover, which follows up immediately after the end of the series. So it's a crossover that counts. It actually ties into the series.
An in-continuity crossover?
Yep.
Oh.
All of ours are. All of our the Chucky one, the Reanimator one, they're all important to the overall story, and which causes me some amount of pain in the ass, but I wanted it to be that way. I wanted it to always be that there's no story that isn't part of the, you know...
They're all equal amounts of imaginary?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Some are more imaginary than others. And what's the next thing? You got the Hoax Hunters story in the Case Files, which was a great little story.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I've got actually like a fair amount of projects coming up. It's nice that a lot of my stuff kind of wound down, and now it's, I guess, because people are like, oh, Revival, you can actually write. Now I'm actually getting a fair amount of good writing jobs, so I've got some cool stuff coming up. At some point, I have to figure out what to do with bringing Hack Slash back. I got to figure something out. But mostly Revival is, like, taking my time the last couple of months because it is a very, like, complex story to write.
And are you sticking monthly or are you doing kind of arcs and breaks?
We have some breaks just to get Mike a chance to catch up, but it is monthly. We take a break. We take a break between 14 and 15 so that we can put out the hardcover, which is going to involve us having to, you know, put together a new book. So that'll take us some time. But other than that, it'll definitely be a, you know, fully monthly, you know. Very rarely will we take breaks.
Thanks a lot, man.
Thanks, man.
Have a good day.
You too. So yeah, that's the goal. Keep it as monthly as possible. I think otherwise people forget you, you know.
So you easy to get lost on the shelves.
Yeah, so much new stuff, so.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
All right, man. Thank you.
So we're here at the Calgary Horror Con.
Yeah.
2013.
Can you believe that?
And you are reassembled with many of the cast of Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah, Bill Moseley, Tony Todd, and our director Tom Savini. We're all together again. I can't even remember the last time that's happened. Really can't.
Well, kind of like high school reunion.
Yeah, well, I see Bill on the road all the time, and Tom and I bump into each other, but we haven't seen Tom in maybe 10 years.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, but we're Facebook friends, so, you know, that's how people stay in touch these days. So we're on Facebook.
it's the next best thing to actually.
It is, and I feel like I've been talking to him, yeah.
And you're going to see the movie tonight?
Yeah, on the big screen, which I haven't seen since it opened. I haven't seen it on the big screen, so this will be interesting.
When was the last time you watched it? Not on the big screen.
Oh, I hate to tell you, probably also in 1990. I haven't revisited it. I see clips of it, you know, or I'll bump into it on flipping channels and I'll see a little bit. But.
Now, a lot of people don't have that experience of flipping through channels and
seeing themselves.
Seeing, oh, look, it's my baby pictures.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it's interesting.
And was that it? Now, were you a stuntwoman or actress first? Which
I've been acting professionally since I was 15, and I started doing stunts. I was, I think, around 26, 27, something like that. Yeah.
And was it just was that a sideline, or was it a way to get?
No, it was a way to make some money. it made me much better living than waiting tables or, you know, working retail. So, and it was in my union, so it just made sense. Turned out I was good at it too, so who knew? Yeah.
How long did you continue working at doing stunt work?
I still get called to do stunts upon occasion, so that's a long time. And I don't really look for that work. I'm older now and I don't want to do it, so I'm running a studio now. I don't really have the time.
Well, let's talk about Studio JMS.
Yeah.
I was at San Diego when it was announced last year.
Oh, yeah. Okay,
so
good.
It was really a great energy in that room.
Yeah, it was fun.
To
the dancing zombies. You saw the dancing zombies. Yeah.
I was like second row, so the dancing zombies were right there.
Oh, my God.
And
yeah, that was Joe's idea. I hated it. I said, what? No. Dancing zombies. That's a terrible idea. Then he said, no, Irish step dancing zombies. It has to be. So, of course, I had to do all of that. But he was right. It was a big hit. And I hate that he was right.
So how much of your gig as CEO of Studio JMS, so how much of your gig is business, and how much of it is making Joe's dreams come true then?
No, right now it's all business. It's I mean, the first year of setting up any business is there's just so many details, and it's glorified office managing, really. And we do have a project next that will start next year for Netflix. We have a series.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah, Joe's writing it with the Wachowskis, who created Matrix. Mm-hmm. And it's called Sense8. And it'll be available for viewing in the fall of 2014. On Netflix.
And the film, how's the film progressing?
That we had to put a halt on that because we were getting ready for the series, or writing the series.
Yeah. And Joe's Comics has started back up as well?
Joe's Comics is going like gangbusters. We have two titles out now, 10 Grand and Sidekick.
Sidekick just this week?
Just this week. Well, Comic-Con, we previewed it with a special variant cover. And now, yes, it's just launched. And Protector Zeke, we were going to preview at New York Comic Con, and then that'll be out the following month.
Fantastic. What kind of schedule are they running?
Every month. They're monthly books.
They are monthly books?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so what else is happening for Studio JMS? What other projects are kind of in the queue after?
Well, I don't talk about anything that's not real. And we've got, I mean, it's Joe Straczynski. You know, there's a ton of stuff. So, but until we have a deal, I'm not talking about it. Joe likes to talk about shit. I don't. We have enough going on, just getting ready for Sense8 and getting those books out. What?
Come on, you have to work.
I'm being interviewed.
Well, I'm sorry.
That's Savini and Tony Todd, and Bill Moseley's eating his popcorn, giving me shit about doing an interview.
Come over, say hi.
Here's lunch.
Thank you. Yeah, that's pretty much it. That's the life of an actor. Can we do a pause thing? Okay, I have to do a photo op. Are you still rolling?
I just left you.
Oh, okay, so you get on your whole bullshit.
We'll see how much.
See what I have to put up with? If you had to put up with that, would you do a lot
but
of
But I saw you continuing to manage everyone.
Oh, I just
did you checked the footage. You rearranged. And none of them noticed it was happening.
Not right.
But I watched you just move people around. You checked and see if the photos came out.
Busted. Busted. Don't tell the boys. It's like herding cats. You know, it is really, it's a challenge. Yesterday it was just all the actors, and they took us on a little tour doing this and that, and it was a nightmare. It was a nightmare. It was like they stopped the bus, and wait, we're missing four people. Where'd they go? You know, the people just disperse, and nobody tells anybody anything. We even had a buddy system. My buddy was Bill Mosley. So... I just sit in the front, so I knew where my buddy was. That was about it. It was a nightmare.
I'm trying to imagine the four of you just with a rope tied.
Pretty much. Oh, I'm so glad I'm not tied to Tony, because he's got a death wish. He does. He's just trouble, that boy. It's bad.
All right, I have no idea where we were, but let's just start from a different spot.
I think we were talking about Studio JMS and and then the comic books, and so that's kept me busy, and I don't have time to do a whole lot else. But I have a lot to look forward to. I think this next year, 2014, is going to be extraordinary, and that'll be finally when we get to dive in and do something creative. Because right now, it's been administrative.
Right, and how much had you built before the big announcement, and how much was just now we hit the ground running?
We've been talking about it for a while. We decided to launch in Comic-Con, and then it accelerated, because Comic-Con is, you know, only every July, so we really wanted to do it there, and that lit the fire for us to make it happen.
And I saw some of the footage of the Babylon 5 reunion in Phoenix.
Yeah.
What was that experience like? Because you were in the pilot, and then you were gone for
one season,
and
it was back in season two.
Back in season two.
Yeah, it was surprisingly emotional. It was great to see everybody. That was fun. I see several cast members on a regular basis. We have dinner. Chat. So, but I hadn't seen Peter for a while, because he's moved to North Carolina, so he's a different state, and that was really fantastic. Plus, it was just special to be together and talk about the show.
Yeah.
You know, which we haven't done ever. You know, like that, on that scale. There's 14 or 15 of us from the show. So, and then John Flynn, who was our director of photography, happens to live in Phoenix, and I surprised everybody. I had thrown a dinner for Thursday night with Joe. We put together a dinner for everybody, just the actors and Babylon 5 folks, and I had John come in as a surprise, and that was so much fun, just to be together Thursday night. And then we started, hit the ground running on Friday and through the weekend. And the convention had put together a reel that was a memorial reel of everyone who's passed away in Babylon 5, which was incredibly disturbing. And I know it was a very sweet gesture on their part. I just wish it had been during the panel, because we were all so wrecked. After seeing that, it's very hard to get the mood back and to so the whole thing was very emotional.
It seemed, I am a big fan of Babylon 5. It's probably my favorite show ever. So I wear that on my sleeve. The next thing I have coming up is actually getting my photo taken 10 feet away from here with you.
Okay.
Because I've started collecting up photos of myself with cast members.
I think it's a really fun thing to do.
And Bruce Boxleitner was at the San Diego last year. I was able to meet him. And but it seemed like a really, like an extraordinarily close cast.
Yeah. I've been on a lot of shows, and this is by far the closest cast I've ever been involved in. And we're still really good friends after 20 years. It's pretty amazing. We've seen each other's kids grow up, and, you know, we talk online, and we have dinner.
But it's you hear some people talk about shows that they're on even longer than Babylon 5, and, you know, it's like a job, and you leave a job, and maybe one or two people you keep in touch with.
Yeah.
This didn't...
We just had a different, I don't know, a different chemistry, and you can't fake that. You know, it just either happens or it doesn't.
And, obviously, story-wise, your character is, Lita, has all of the question marks left. All of the others, the novels that were written after, the Lost Tales movie, Crusade, your character is the big untold story.
I guess so.
Of the saga.
I guess so.
The telepath war, mm-hmm. that's talked about, and then one of the novels covers after that.
Mm.
Was there ever an intention to tell that story, or
no? I don't think so. I think who knows? But Joe did what he did, and with the show, he had that arc planned. We finished the show. Crusade didn't go. And I think that he's just, we're moved on pretty much. If there were to be more or another Babylon 5, it would have a whole new thing. I don't think he would go back and revisit old stuff so much. Let's just move on to new stuff.
Well, it's wonderful to have that the show existed, and everything after that, at that original 5-year plan, was gravy for the fans. So it was all just extra blessings, because we knew that the 5 years was what was supposed to exist.
Right, right. It's hard. It's not Doctor Who, You can't keep going for 50 years. You can't keep regenerating. This doesn't happen.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
And all the best with Studio JMS.
Thank you.
We've reviewed both the number ones on We Talk Podcast.
Thank you.
And really look forward to the comics coming out.
Yeah, that Protector's Ink. We've got 3 more coming out in 2014 too. So we'll have 6 books going strong. I love 10 Grand. Sidekick's amazing, but 10 Grand's really special to me because it's our first. So I hope you guys read it, enjoy it. There's more photo ops going on in the background here. You can go to studiojms.com and kind of see what's going on, or my Facebook page, Patricia Tallman page. I'm posting what's going on, so stay in touch with us there.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Welcome to Comic Book Attractions, the part of the show where we remind you of movies good, bad, old, and new that are based on comic books that should be watched and enjoyed. Tonight, I'm lucky enough to be joined by our regular We Talk Comics co-host, Keith, because he saw the new incarnation of the Wolverine, and so did I. We haven't discussed this. It's going to probably kind of spoilery. That's why we tack these things on the end. I can't wait to hear what Keith has to say. Keith, what did you think of The Wolverine?
I cannot express enough how cautious I was with this movie. I had made the decision absolutely that I was not going to go to the theater and see this film. The Wolverine Origins, my wife almost walked out of, and it was my birthday movie that year. It was the only reason she didn't walk out of it. She would have just left me to find my own way home had it not been my birthday. And the only reason I stayed to the end of that movie was that I know for a fact that I would have at some point watched the entire thing, and there was no reason to have suffered through that half hour, 40 minutes twice. That said, I did on a whim, I was out, my wife and I were out running errands, and she was driving, and she said, "What do you want to do with your afternoon?" And I want to just go home. Well, you want to go for a walk? I'm like, I kind of want to see a movie, but the only thing out is The Wolverine. And she said, "Well, I'm going to go do anything but that." The Wolverine is a man made by myself. And I will say I was pleasantly surprised. I would not think my favorite ever movie, but I think it is, it sits well with X-Men 1 and 2, and X-Men 3 is a flawed film, but I like that this film built out of X-Men 3. It is a proper sequel to X-Men 3, as well as the mid-credit scene that ties it all back into the next X-Men movie, Days of Past. So I was happy with what I saw. I was surprised to have enjoyed as much as I did. It all kind of worked for me. I I dug the extra characters. I mean, the only thing I really didn't care for was Viper. I thought she was annoying to a huge extent every moment she was on the screen. I didn't like the way her powers were dealt with. It was kind of the element of cheesy, silly, in the midst of a more serious take on a character and on the X-Universe. So,
Christopher. Yeah, I'm hearing what you're saying. And honestly, I left this film not knowing whether I liked it or not. And that's because the comic book geek in me, this is based off Frank Miller's and Chris Claremont's original four-issue limited series. And it gets so close to the original source material and then veers drastically away that I kept having geekgasms that I had nowhere to go with. First couple scenes, I'm getting excited for the big bear fight. I don't get a big bear fight. There's a bear. Everything that happens, but there's no bear fight. Wolverine goes to Japan. In the comic book, he gets all sorts of ninja weapons. Well, Wolverine the movie goes to Japan, no ninja weapons, and doesn't know that sticking chopsticks in the rice is a bad idea. We get Silver Samurai. But it's not Silver Samurai, it's a big-ass robot. We get so much stuff, we just get right to that point, and then they just pull the rug under me. It's not a bad film, I just found it so hard as a geek to get into this film. I will agree with you, Viper was a terrible idea. It's one of the tropes in movies that I hate the most. If we have a kick-ass villain or a kick-ass girl in a movie, we have to have a kick-ass villain for her to fight while the big strong men are fighting it out elsewhere. She was unneeded, and her powers were, quite frankly, kind of stupid. Did you have a favorite moment in the movie, Keith?
Favorite moment? I do have a favorite moment in the film. It's when he's, it is one that I believe is straight out of the comic. It's been a long time since I read the comic, and it's not one of my favorite Miller stories. So I don't have the adoration for it that I know so many do. It's the moment when he's going to find, Mariko, and the ninjas attack him. They find out he's got his healing power back. And then they do all the chains flying to him and drag him down finally because they hit him with so many arrows and have finally taken him down and can drag him in. But it's just that long shot where Mariko is seeing him, and that was the only lit part of the town, and they're all surrounding him. It takes like, you know, a million bazillion, what's the tick thing, a million billion ninjas to take him down, but it's all part of his name.
Hmm.
I just love that visual.
And do you, on a whole, do you like the Jean Grey Wolverine Cyclops love triangle? I think that was part of my disconnect with this movie, is I've never bought the Wolverine. I always thought, well, she didn't want to have anything to do with him, really. It was a one-sided relationship. I don't like that part of the Chris Claremont run in the X-Men all that much. And in the movie, it was like, oh, okay. The least said about X-Men 3, the better. Let's just ignore that part. And I thought that actually hurt the love interest in Japan. Plus, I mean, you have a Yukio in Japan to actually supply that tension, and she's complete. The relationship there in the movie is completely lost. I guess I'm saying I didn't have a favorite moment, although the bullet train fight was kind of fun.
That was exciting. I thought that was the fight on top of the bullet train. I thought that was pretty exciting. I actually really liked the Jean Grey relationship, and for two reasons. One is, it does tie so tightly into the other X-Men movies, which I thought was a real strength of the film, that you didn't have to have seen it, but it did assume that most people had. And I like that it didn't pretend it didn't exist. And two, as you said, that it was a one-sided relationship, it absolutely still is. I mean, this isn't Jean Grey's psyche that's trapped inside Wolverine's brain or anything. This is entirely Wolverine's guilt over what he had to do.
Oh, I just think Wolverine has enough to worry about without stressing over this one particular oops. He's had a couple oopses in his time. So I guess we're actually generally positive on this, which is a shock, considering I know we are both violently opposed to Wolverine Origins. And I have to say, I am kind of primed for the next X-Men movie. I really want to see how they're going to connect X-Men First Class and the rest of the franchise, or if they're going to even try.
Well, I mean, everything I've heard is that that Singer is really set on threading these together into what is it now? 7 films. This will be the 7th. We got the X-Men, First Class, Wolverine, The Wolverine. Yeah, so this will be the 7th film, and Singer's goal is to make this 7 films that are all one universe. And he's using time travel to play that, to make it all flow.
I wonder if he's going to even try to attempt to address some of the problems with Wolverine Origins, or if he needs to. Maybe it's just going to be a 6-film set.
I don't know that he needs to. I mean, in general, you know, there's a couple of wonky things. I mean, the character who appears to be Emma Frost, who's not the same as the one that's in First Class, the timing of that First Class establishes that what age Xavier was when he was crippled, and Origins contradicts that. But I mean, once you throw in time travel, all that stuff kind of becomes a wash anyway.
Yeah.
And I don't think that there's any great purpose or great need to pull things out of Origins and tie them in. I think it's really just in the case of, you know, the one thread of all of these is that we've got Hugh Jackman playing Wolverine in all 7 films. And he's, again, going to be the focus of Days of Future Past. I don't know if you have heard this part, I don't think it's going to be spoilery because the trailers, I'm sure, will show it all. It's not Kitty Pryde time traveling in Days of Future Past, it's Logan. And the reason for that is that they can use the same actor in the future as they do in the past. That was the reasoning of changing it to Logan instead of Kitty. In the original, it was an older Kitty transfers into like teenage Kitty's body in the comic.
Did you stay for the end sequence? I missed it, actually. They turned on the lights in my theater, and I did not get to see it until later on YouTube.
I was as excited for that post-credit sequence or mid-credit sequence that teases Days of Future Past as I was for Thanos. I lost my mind. I know the scene is out there, as we said, we're spoiling. So it is a scene that has Patrick Stewart, Ian McKellen, and Hugh Jackman in it, and sets up a bit of a thread. I know this is, I had read that this was actually at the assistance of Martin Miller, who is kind of show running the Fox movies. And specific point of making sure that all of these do thread together. I don't know. It made me so excited for Days of Future Past.
Well, thanks, Keith. Right now, I think we're losing our internet connection. So, and I think we've discussed this movie enough. I think it's a solid thumbs up from both of us. I liked it less than you did, but definitely, it's no Wolverine Origins. People can relax, breathe a sign of relief. and the film probably looks works better if you just ignore everything there and don't have a huge attachment to the comic books. Until next time, this is Chris _ We Talk and Cub Reporter K on Twitter. You got any plugs or anything before we go?
No, coming up soon, more interviews and content from the Chicago Comic Con.
Can't wait to hear that. All right. We're out.